Loved by J.K. Chesterton, J.R.R. Tolkien, and Evelyn Waugh, the Catholic Herald magazine has been a bold and influential voice in the church since 1888, standing up for traditional Catholic culture and values. Subscribe today for print and digital access by visiting our website at www.catholicherald.co.uk.
The Catholic Herald has a number of stellar journalists on its staff, amongst whom Simon Caldwell is one of the most experienced and respected. Not only a seasoned journalist who's worked for the most successful secular titles, he's a published novelist. As it happens, his latest novel contains some exotic and fascinating supernatural Catholic phenomena, and since he's also written powerfully about a number of the apparitions in The Spectator and elsewhere, he's something of an expert. And I thought Simon was the best person to turn to talk about the new Vatican guidelines for assessing the validity of the supernatural. As it happens, he and I represent perhaps the two sides in the emerging debate. Simon is ruthlessly and forensically questioning, and I'm more inclined to a celebratory enthusiasm. But as we discussed the issues before we pressed record, there was a fresh realization the Catholic Church needs both of these responses to make best sense of the miraculous and supernatural claims we're presented with. Simon joins me now. Simon, this is an unusual pleasure. We're normally doing different things together as colleagues at the Catholic Herald. But as it happens, given that we're going to be discussing the issue of the supernatural and how it's validated, you're really a good man to talk to because you have some experience of it in terms of writing about it. But not only do you write as a critic in the best sense, but you've slip some of this into your latest novel. Do you want to just, partly as a way of giving you a platform to talk about your novel, which I think we should begin with, do you want to explain why, particularly as a critic, you've written about private revelation as a novelist?
Well, I think it's a fascinating subject, essentially. I'm not opposed to private revelation per se. I just think that, you know, but having studied quite a number of cases, and it's clear to me that the vast majority of these claims are false, and sometimes people can be misled, defrauded, they can be taken away from the saving graces of the Mother Church, by misled by false prophets, and the reason why I slipped into my latest novel, which is called Lady Mabel's Gold, and all being well, it should be out in October, is because it makes great subject matter for a story. We have in this situation, you have a teacher who claims she's experiencing supernatural phenomena. She's bleeding from her head in one scene, as if she's wearing an invisible crown of thorns. And Calvin Baines, my hero priest, is put in charge of her and asked to find out whether she's a fraud or not. And of course, this is a crime thriller, so all kinds of things happen. She's based loosely on a woman who was local to my area called Teresa Higginson, who in the late 19th century, she was a Victorian school teacher who came to Wigan to teach. And I think she was in her late 20s and early 30s when she started being oppressed by the devil with all kinds of unseen blows to the face. And she experienced bleeding from her head like my character does, and then she went on to receive the stigmata, and she had this and to undergo the mystical marriage which Saint Teresa of Avila describes, and then she was given a private revelation, which is quite a sensible one to my mind, which was the idea of rekindling the devotion to holy wisdom, which has always been there from the beginning. And this is the thing about private revelations, so they don't bring anything new. If they bring anything new to the table, it's usually a sign that they're fake. And what Teresa Higginson asked for was a devotion to the Christ's sacred head as a seat of divine wisdom, as an antidote to intellectual pride, which at the turn of the, you know, going into the 20th century seemed very priestly, very apposite. And there are people who acted as their spiritual director, and there's one priest who said, not only is she a saint, but this woman is one of the greatest saints that the church has ever raised. And with about 30 years, Archdiocese of Liverpool opened a cause, I think it passed through the diocese. I have to check on that, but it has passed through the diocesan phase and went to the Vatican, who, within a matter of years, closed it. But they didn't say it was wrong. They didn't. There was no moral error whatsoever that they came across. But they shelved it effectively, saying they gave I can't remember exactly the phrase now, but it's a Latin term saying not now. It means we proceed now, and they put it in their archives and then they left it alone. It might have been that there'd been a glut of these private revelations at the same time. We have like Saint Faustina Kowalska and lots of others.
I was just about to mention her.
Yeah, it did cause quite a furore. And you had people like Evelyn Waugh writing to the Catholic press, a huge lot of debates about what happened to Teresa Cakenson, whether these revelations were true or not. And in recent years, there have been attempts to get the cause going again, and I think they were declined on the grounds that nothing new had been brought that would mean that this case should be reviewed or looked at again. So this particular character, she has things in common with Teresa Higginson, but I don't want to say too much because I wouldn't like to ruin the story for the readers. But yeah, it took me back to my interest in private revelations again. I do find it a fascinating area for all kinds of different reasons. And of course, the new Vatican documents, which has just come out, didn't escape my attention. I read that with great interest.
So that's what we'll talk about. We'll get to that in a moment, but let's do our natural theology first. I'm not sure if you're saying that in your view, the Teresa Higginson revelation or phenomenon, were you're agnostic about it or you're sceptical about it.
I've got an open mind. I mean, I think the message, I think the devotion to divine wisdom, I think, is a good one. And if you take, for example, it's always been there. If you take the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, that's what it means. It means holy wisdom. So there was this devotion, especially in Orthodox Christianity, Eastern Orthodox, to the holy wisdom. And I do actually think that would be it would be a good devotion and a sound and theologically robust devotion. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. But Teresa might come across to some people as a difficult character because she was one of these people who was given to excessive self-mortification. She did all kinds of things which normal people just say, how could you? You know, pulling the toenails out and all this kind of thing. But she isn't alone in doing that, because sometimes these victim souls, they have this very, very powerful impulse to suffer. They want to suffer in union with Christ. They want to make spiritual sacrifices in union with Christ for the conversion of sinners and for the salvation of mankind. And she felt very deeply drawn to suffering in union with Christ. But there's plenty of examples of saints down centuries who've been just like her. Rose of Lima, Gemma Galgani, she fitted into that mold. Padre Pio. So there's a man who happily accepted the stigmata and the sufferings of Christ in his own person for the salvation of souls. And Teresa was that kind of person. Whether we're ready for a victim soul of that kind in our age, maybe it's a good thing we did have that kind of model again in the church. But other people would say, well, it isn't. She belongs to another era. But it's certainly a part of Christian mystical theology. I just don't feel like I'm in a position to judge her. I admire her and I like the message, but I would like to the church authorities to spend more time scrutinizing what she said and to come up with a proper decision whether she was a real thing or not.
Well, it sounds to me as though your provision, your hesitation and your provisionality is a very sane and a very informed response. One of the reasons I'm interested is that I came across a contemporary. I'm not going to give any names to avoid any litigious responses, but a very interesting woman who was in charge of an ecumenical movement, who claimed to be getting messages from God, and I thought they were very profound. However, towards the end, I thought she was making it up. She began to write, for example, about contemporary issues in the church. I then discovered that the Nihil Obstat that her writings have been given were provided by a bishop
who had a diocese in India, and nothing to do with her at all. In other words, she was manipulating the process to give the appearance of affirmation by the church. And so I think I came away thinking, I think there's some very authentic stuff here, which is what drew me there in the first place. But it went wrong. She wasn't accountable to anybody. She was not under any authority, under any oversight. She wasn't even actually Roman Catholic. I thought this is probably quite normative, that there are people who genuinely experience authentic phenomena, but for all kinds of reasons, it can go wrong, become corrupted, become distorted. There's no guarantee, just because it starts off by being authentic, that it's going to remain protected and without flaw or deception all the way through. Much depends upon the level of spiritual oversight that there is and the level of humility that there is. Like you, I'm quite invested in the process because I think I've had my fingers burnt to some extent. But on the other hand, I want to give credence to those moments when God seems to act in order to bring the church back to its senses, which is what I think probably the purpose of private revelation ought to be. I mean, talk us a bit more about Helena Faustina, because she's a very good example of someone who there didn't seem anything wrong in it, and yet the church slapped a prohibition on her quite early, which it later reversed.
Yeah, I do actually pray the Divine Mercy in the Easter Octave, like so many other Catholics. I think it's a wonderful prayer. I don't know an awful lot about Saint Faustina, except that like as you said, she was her revelations, her experience was suppressed. Her message was suppressed for a long time before Pope John Paul II made the devotion extremely popular. Perhaps that is a sign of how cautious the church is on these matters. I mean, we also the other manifestations, I suppose, or private revelations, which the church has given credence to, are Guadalupe in Mexico, Lourdes in France, and Fatima. And they all tend to, like I say, they tend to bring people, the idea is to bring people closer to God and to renew the life of the church. They invariably call for conversion and repentance. They warn people against sin. Especially Fatima was extremely, that was explicit in that regard. I mean, we were then going into the great sort of secularism of the 20th century ideologies, and Our Lady made a very clear statement that hell is real and souls will go there, and she implored the children to tell everybody, to tell the world, to pray for that souls won't be lost to hell. So I think the thing about public revelation, we start with public revelation, that's everything that you need for salvation is in public revelation, which is basically the end of the last gospel. You don't need anything else. You don't need to have any extra add-ons. But I think the purpose of private revelations, when they're genuine, is to shine a light in it, and perhaps a way of means of devotion, or a way of leading people to God at a certain time in a certain historical context. So you might have like the Sacred Heart after the time of the French Revolution, that kind of thing. So I don't think that they're bringing anything new. So I think when you talk about the signs of deception, it's usually when these revelations either distort genuine church teaching, the teaching which is supported by scripture and tradition, or they bring something new. Those should be two serious red flags. If somebody starts saying things like, I mean, we had a few years ago, there's a woman called Patricia de Menezes who had a devotion to Our Lady of Surbiton. She claimed that she was seeing the Virgin Mary in a back garden, I think, down on the banks of the River Thames. Her devotion was to the Divine Innocence, and she declared that every aborted baby was a martyr. And that movement had quite a sizable body of followers, but it was suppressed by the Archdiocese of Southwark because of the inherent heresies. And the Vatican supported the Archbishop.
It was very interesting you should talk about Our Lady of Surbiton. I've got a story about Our Lady of East Molesey, whom you'll never have heard of, but just tell it for general entertainment. A very good friend of mine was a Protestant, originally a Presbyterian theologian called Tom Smale. He was one of Karl Barth's preeminent research pupils, and he was involved in being a leader of the charismatic movement in the 1970s, along with Michael Harper, David Watson, and others. And Tom was a marvelous man and a very serious intellectual, but he was profoundly pushed away from his Presbyterianism, sadly only as far as Anglicanism, by an experience of Our Lady in East Molesey. So what was happening was, so during this period, he was connected with a pastorate in Belfast. That's important because one morning Our Lady made herself made him aware of her, and he was shocked by this as a good Scottish Presbyterian with pastoral roots in Belfast. And he said to her, "What are you here for?" And she said, "I've come to help you adore my son." Now, later on, when he was talking about this, he said, and I don't think he did, I think he said it later, "Well, that's a rather better answer than you gave to Bernadette." And Tom was a friend of mine, and I remember towards the end of his life, I got a recording of this because I thought it would be historically interesting. And I said, "Tom, you know, why did you have such a problem with the Immaculate Conception?" And then he trotted out a whole load of reflex Protestant responses. But the reason it was very powerful was that when he went around telling Presbyterians, the Virgin Mary has made herself known to me, this had the most enormous impact, both for good, as you can imagine, and also for bad. But it marked, it drove him considerably closer to the Catholic Church, not as far as it would have done. Now, of course, all Protestants said, well, this is entirely delusional and of the devil. And he didn't think it was. But one of the things that concerns me about the Vatican's latest document is that apparitions at Lourdes and at Fatima and at Guadalupe are all immensely significant in historical terms. Lourdes because of Our Lady solving a theological debate that was about to become proclaimed dogma. Guadalupe because 10 million people had been lost to the Catholic Church in Europe, only to have to be replaced by 10 million Mexicans in the New World. And Fatima, because it marked, I think, a pivotal point in the Church's conflict with Marxist ideology, which continues to this day with cultural Marxism. And so when people, as they try and offer some form of interpretation about the theological dynamics of our world, look to these things, they have the confidence of saying, well, the Church has looked at it. The Church has been immensely sceptical. I mean, there's very few people understand the level of scepticism brought to the religious miracles at Lourdes, which involve people who are not Catholic, not believers, and are occupy serious levels of professionalism with the medical fraternity. They assume, perhaps, that the Church wants to be gullible, but the Church wants to do what you're doing, which is to be very extremely hesitant in order to preserve the distinction between the authentic and the inauthentic. The thing that worried me, sorry, this is a long sentence, but the thing that worries me about the latest Vatican pronouncement is that it's going to remove the capacity of believers to have a confidence in the Church's judgment about the supernatural on those rare occasions, because they are rare, where the Church makes up its mind and says this is something you can be relied on. It's going to throw people back into their preferential supernatural experience, their preferential miracle. And this, I think, this is a retrograde step. What do you think?
Yeah, they trouble me as well a little bit. I think what the if we take Cardinal Fernandez at his word, which I think we have to do in the first instance, he was saying that, well, we need to update the way we do things, because we now live in a world where information travels around the planet very, very quickly. And if somebody stands up in India and says, "I've seen the Virgin Mary," then, you know,
everyone knows about it by tea time. Yes,
of course. Yeah. And so they need to support the the local church in discerning what's happening and bringing forth a judgment. There are a few things that so in that sense, it's a good thing because it means that if it's fraudulence involved or somebody who's delusional or doing it for ideological reasons or for any other reasons, any dishonorable motive, then they can bring it to an end very, very quickly. And it doesn't get all out of proportion and dealt with 30 years later when 30 million people have been on pilgrimage there and absolutely attached to the seers or the apparition is supposed to be saying. They don't have to then close the stable door after the horse's bolted. I don't think they'd do that because they wouldn't want a schism of all these people leaving the church or suddenly at odds with the legitimate authority of the church, which tends to happen. So in that sense, it's a good thing. But there's a few things that trouble me. One is the centralization of authority. It's moving the power to make decisions from the local bishops, from the local church, to the censor, to the Pope. And I don't think it's good for the papacy to become like an absolute monarch. I mean, you've had this conversation with other guests before, and these guidelines do. They say, okay, the bishops can investigate it, and then they send their views to the DDF, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, who take an opinion, and then they issue one of six statements. But what the bishop can't do is say, I believe this to be valid. This apparition to be valid, whereas in the past they could. The bishops had the charism to discern whether an apparition was valid or not. And you've got to think about the church in universal terms. In the old days, if Our Lady, for example, appeared in Guadalupe in Mexico, the Pope wasn't in a position to decide whether it was valid or not. It had to be the local bishop. So the bishops do have the charism to do that, but all of a sudden that function is now being reserved to Rome. So the bishops can say it's fake. But they can't say it's true under these new guidelines. And then there's also what the guidance also does is there's lots and lots of stages in between. You don't just get it's fake or it's real or it's false. There's three or four categories in which they say, well, there's nothing heretical coming out of there, but there's something a bit dodgy about one or two other aspects that you might need to know about before you go there. So. It allows, for example, revelations which are fraudulent but appear orthodox to continue, and that's a compromise. I think that's a fudge.
Yes, and it seems to me that it's almost like a new form of pneumatic ultramontanism because it's not as if many bishops have been caught. Carelessly affirming the supernatural. On the whole, my reading of the history of this phenomena is that bishops are super cautious. Gallobondale, for example, well, wherever you look, on the whole, the episcopate has been very wary, partly because of the implications of getting it wrong. And so I think quite rightly the church has always leaned towards the sceptical for all the reasons that you talked about your own preferred position to be sceptical. I'd be very grateful if you could summarize, if you're willing to, at least an article you wrote for The Spectator, because I remember when I read it thinking, this is a very powerful and well-written piece. And although I'm probably slightly more pietistic by nature than you are, your hard-bitten scepticism is actually one of the things that is most useful in terms of getting to the heart of whether something is real or not, because the more you push it, the more you test it, the more, in a sense, less resistant one is to gullibility, the more you're likely to discover the diamond at the heart of the whole thing. Why did you write this article, The Spectator? And can you summarize some of the things?
Well, first of all, what I want to say is I don't. It's not an attack on people who have a devotion to the Virgin Mary or who feel drawn. To Marian piety. I've been saying the rosary every day for nearly 30 years. That's my rule. It might be like three or four times a year when I don't, because I might be overtaken by events or something like that, and I can't. So I do have a strong devotion to the Virgin Mary. And also, it's not, and I don't have a particular beef against people who support Medjugorje. Some, I know some incredibly nice, very, very pious people who have a strong devotion to Medjugorje and been there on pilgrimage many times. And I don't have an issue with them. But I have to be honest with myself. And when I looked at what was happening there, I came to the conclusion that I didn't, you know, that it's probably false, and I didn't believe it.
Say something there? So, it seems to me that the one, partly because of what I said near the beginning, with my own attachment to a source of private revelation that I thought began well and ended badly. Why isn't it possible that Medjugorje began well and got complex, or I mean, one of the problems with Medjugorje is that it spanned decades, and surely during those decades, it's only more than likely that things would go wrong. Isn't it almost normative?
Medjugorje started badly and has gone well.
Ended badly.
Really? Because if you look at the genesis of the phenomenon, you're talking about ultra-nationalistic group of Franciscan friars. Croatian Franciscan friars in what was then Yugoslavia, who'd been allied to the Nazis in the Second World War. There was one of them who came there, I think it was he was known as a butch, so I can tell you the exact name of the concentration camp where he was based. Yeah, it's slipped my mind. He was the butcher Jan Senovac. He was a friar called Father Mirasovlich Filopovic. And the Franciscan friars who were behind Medjugorje were his successors. And they were squabbling with Paul VI, who issued a bull which demanded that they were obedient to him. And they resisted. Well, it was convenient for them that Our Lady started appearing in one of their parishes. And there were six children who were under the control of a man called Tomislav Vlasic. And he claimed, stood up and said, "I'm the spiritual director." Now, Vlasic has since been laicized by the church because this is why I thought I did the piece with the Spectator, because there's a great story behind this. Is Vlasic had an affair with a nun called Manda Kozel, Sister Rafina, and she became pregnant. And to cover up, he sent her off to Germany, and he manipulated her. He wrote to her saying, "You must be like Mary when she, you know, go to a far place, take your child to a far place, and don't tell anybody I'm the father, etc., etc. And of course, I'll join you in a short while," which she had no intention of. And she had the baby on her own in a flat in Munich, and she had this correspondence with him which she left behind, and it fell into the hands of her landlord, who passed it on to the Archbishop of Munich, who happened to be Joseph Ratzinger. So Ratzinger becomes goes to the Vatican and becomes the prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, and he has an understanding of what was happening in Medjugorje, and he knew who was pulling the strings, and he moves against them. So he says, because he understood the background, he said he supported the local bishops with two bishops, successive bishops, Pavo Zanich and Ratko Peric, and they both said, they issued the strongest declaration they could: there is nothing supernatural happening here. They thought the whole situation was manipulated by this corpus of rebellious Franciscans. And Benedict supported them, and he said, "No pilgrimages. You cannot go on pilgrimage to Medjugorje if you think that you are going there because the Virgin Mary has appeared there. You could go there and you could pray there, but you couldn't go on pilgrimage there." So what happens is Benedict then moves against Vlasic in particular, and he accused him of all kinds. He was accused of heresy, schism, sexual immorality, aggravated by mystical motivation, the diffusion of dubious doctrine, manipulation of consciences, suspect mysticism, and disobedience towards legitimately issued orders. He couldn't have hit him with a bigger stick, and it was all in the context of Medjugorje. But what happened is, Benedict thought he actually laughed out publicly when they talked about the 40,000 messages that had been received and the 57 secrets. And Francis has taken exactly the same attitude. He said, "This isn't Our Lady. It's not how she works."
But, curiously enough, one of the few things that I'm grateful to Pope Francis about, I think, is his rather laconic phrase that Our Lady doesn't act like a kind of postmistress of postcards. I mean,
yeah, that's exactly what he said.
And I thought that was, to give him his due, I thought that was astute and on the button. Can one make a distinction between the original experiences of the children and the way in which they've become handled, misused, or abused in the process of becoming public? Or do you think the whole thing was fraudulent from the very beginning?
Well, being a little bit of a skeptic, I think it's fraudulent from the beginning. But I know there are some people who think that there is something diabolical about it as well. Maybe the children saw something that wasn't Our Lady. Who knows? I'm not going to say that.
But there is
a school of thought about that. But one of the things about Medjugorje now that I just want to add this because is that people do go there and they do have very positive religious experiences. And I know some very, you know, it's changed people's lives. And there is some, I think it was Schoenbohm, for example, the Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna, said that if it wasn't for Medjugorje, you have no priests. So people are still going there, and so I think however it started, it still does. It now seems to be like when two or three people gather in my name and pray, then I'm there in the midst of them. I think people do go there and find an authentic devotion to our, nurture an authentic devotion to Our Lady, or have positive religious experiences. But I really don't believe that Our Lady appeared there.
So this is very interesting. When we discussed how we were going to manage this conversation beforehand, you said you were going to come at it with some degree of scepticism, and I said, well, I was going to come at it with some degree of pious expectation, and therefore this is the Catholic Herald being wonderfully balanced. And people, I mean, clearly you've been very well informed from the moment as a journalist you began to look into this. One of the things that one of the criteria that I think I would follow would be to start with William James. William James, who wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, about 1907 was Freud's paper, about 1917, I think. And James said, well, we have to be agnostic about most claims, but one of the things we can do is to trace something that has unusual and unexpected fruit back and say, retrospectively, this ought to incline us to be more generous in our estimation of it. You're quite right, I'm sure you're right, about being very wary about diabolical copying. But if it had a diabolical origin, it would have been harder to pull round because, as you quite rightly say, there's been a level of sanctification of experience as people have made their pilgrimages. People have had profound encounters with God there, and some would say verging on the miraculous. Is it likely that something that begins with a satanic root could be sanctified and redeemed to that extent?
I think it's inherently dangerous if that's the case. I think this is going to be one of those cases where the Vatican's just going to let people go. And not stop them, never stop them, and never ever pronounce on the validity of Medjugorje. I think that's going to be it's going to sit in the middle ground because they think that is there's too much good coming out of there. But at the same time, there are bad things coming out of there as well.
I've heard it said that one of the reasons for producing this document now, updating. Was it Pope Paul VI in 78, the last time they were reviewed?
Yeah.
But before that, the 16th century. So the 16th century to Pope Paul VI is quite a leap. To suddenly only have a couple of decades before they start tinkering again, there must be a reason. What's the reason? Some people have suggested it's a local fraudulent visionary in Italy. But more sensibly, I think, this lets the church off the hook forever about having to make a divisive decision about Medjugorje. Do you think that may be one of the reasons?
It'll be certainly one of the things that will flow from this document. But at the same time, it also stops another Medjugorje from happening. So for example, if you had a similar situation where you have the friars manipulating children, and the bishop said, "Look, I've got a problem here," they just stop it straight away. They could move that quickly. So the Medjugorje, I mean, you talk about the positive fruits there. There are negative fruits, and they're the same kind of fruits that you see wherever people end up in cults. They believe the cult leader or the apparition or the seer or the visionary more than the legitimate authority of the church, and they go against the legitimate authority of the church. And that's what happened in Medjugorje. The bishops were told, I think the Franciscans went to Rome and said our bishop's being manipulated by Satan. So there was a rebellion against the authority of the local bishop. And I think on more than one occasion he escaped from with his life. You know, he was almost lynched. And then that factionalism then is exported by other people who come on pilgrimage. They take it back and they want Medjugorje validated in the parishes and by their own bishops, and then there's factions and infighting and discord and division opens up when it doesn't happen. If the Pope comes out and says something against Medjugorje, they'll say, well, I'm with Medjugorje, not with the Pope. So you can see, you know, the devil, one of the things the devil always does is he divides. He's a great divider. And that's how when you have a false private revelation, that's what tends to happen. So that also explains why the church is so cautious. They're not going to put...
Yes. You know. Well, so you're making a very good case for saying that the virtues of the document outweigh the vices, the virtues being saving us from the pressure of commentating on such an enormously popular phenomenon, and also having the capacity to move very quickly against the more obviously fraudulent. But isn't the price isn't the price too high? Perhaps you don't think it is. The price being removing from bishops the legitimate authority they have in their own diocese to talk about their own people and to bear in mind their own local culture, and giving a Vatican whose culture is less than persuasive to a lot of people untrammeled power that it
may be. I'm sure you're right. I mean, if you consider this possible situation, I mean, we now have a Pope who's said on several occasions, I think, that he's starting to feel that there's no one in hell. He's starting to believe that there's no one in hell. And I think Cardinal Fernandez issued the same statement. He said, well, you know, this is the way the Holy Father's thinking. And he said, there is a cult who believes that there are people in hell. Well, it's not a cult. It's tradition and revelation. It's in the catechism that yes. hell exists, and it's where unrepentant the souls of unrepentant evildoers go when they resist all grace. And then when Our Lady appeared at Fatima, she told the children hell is a reality, and she gave them this vision of hell, and she told sinners are going there, and people are going there, and you need this. It's the point of Fatima, really, is to keep souls out of hell.
Yeah.
So if you have a heterodox pope who doesn't believe in hell or doesn't believe that souls go into damned hell, and then you have for example, Our Lady of Fatima, an authentic revelation where you have the Mother of God saying, well, hell is real, then the pope could overrule the local bishop and say, I reject this one because I believe there's no hell, no one in hell. Mm-hmm. And because the Mother of God is saying that there is people in hell, therefore she's false, even though the apparition on that instance would be supported by tradition and scripture and not the Pope. So it's, there's too much central. There's an opportunity again for it all to go wrong. It will be better left in the hands of pious Orthodox bishops and not in the hands of Vatican bureaucrats or popes who are very, very distant from the problem. What the Vatican should have is the right to overrule a wrong decision by a bishop. So that would only happen every now and then.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the extent to which it did or didn't use the power would be the extent to which it was used legitimately or not. I was lucky enough to get to know Abbé René Laurentin in the last decade of his life. And of course, he was perhaps one of the most experienced Mariologists and has produced this extraordinary dictionary, which I should have behind me, on all the apparitions. One of the problems, I mean, he was silenced in his last 10 years of his life, I think over Medjugorje. And I'm not wholly unsympathetic to that. I think you've made a very good case for saying that Medjugorje is potentially enormously problematic, whichever way you play it. if you play it positively, then how does one deal with the fact that there are all the serious issues that you've so carefully documented as a journalist? And if you play it negatively, how do you manage to harness what appear to be entirely legitimate experiences of salvation and sanctification that people bear witness to? So I can very well see that Medjugorje poses almost an insuperable problem, and I think I'm sympathetic to almost any attempt that says here's a way to avoid exacerbating difficulties. But I'm not very impressed by this document. One of the things I hope is that some of the things that have happened over the last few years could be reversed if we have a non-heterodox pope elected. Is this one of them? Could this be revisited in a subsequent papacy and say, well, actually, we see the good reasons why they did this, and there are some, but we still like to retain the responsibility of saying, yes, this is supernatural, and we need to give it the recognition it deserves.
Yeah, I'm sure they could revisit it if they wanted. I mean, what I'd prefer them to do is just be more respectful of the truth, and don't look at whether the pragmatic purposes or what might be gained just for letting things happen, or not giving people sound teaching or truthful judgments. If, for example, Ratko Perić and Bishop Zanić before him have extremely good reasons for rejecting Medjugorje, the Vatican should just support the local bishops and respect their authority and their wisdom and their local knowledge. And that's all they needed to do.
But without, of course, the capacity of the Vatican to declare things authentic, we would have lost Faustina Kowalska, and we'd have lost Padre Pio. I mean, both of them. One of the problems with authentic prophetic revelation is that it makes people who are misbehaving very uncomfortable. And so, the great power of some of these supernatural events is that they provide the Catholic Church with the capacity to renew itself by bringing some level of prophetic discernment and the requirement of accountability to the tradition, to the mind of the Church as it's always been. The danger to have lost Sister Helena Kowalska and Padre Pio would have been, in my judgment, a terrible loss for the Catholic Church in the 20th century. Too high a price to pay, I think.
Yes. I mean, if only there was a simple solution.
Indeed. Well, there we are. There's the novelist. Yeah. Simon, just tell us the name of your novel with them so that we know what it is when it's coming out. Your first
one was very called, good. It's called Lady Mabel's Gold, and if everything goes swimmingly, we'll see it out in up for sale, you know, on sale in all major bookshops, available online in end of October.
And it follows your first one, which some people may not have read.
Yes, that's The Beast of Bethulia Park. Thank you.
You heard it here. Simon Caldwell, thank you very much indeed. Have a wonderful conversation. Bless you.
Thank you, Gavin. Cheers.